Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California, here today with Coleman Hughes, a unique and uniquely unapologetic voice in the world of identity politics. Most famous for his arguments for a colorblind America, Coleman has been thrust to the intellectual front lines of the war of intersectionality and the strange and disturbing anti-Semitic alliances that have formed in the wake of Hamas's terrorist massacre and atrocities in Israel on 10/7. With his characteristically calm, composed, and civil demeanor, and a definitively rational view of the moral implications surrounding the anti-Semitism that has gripped the globe in the past 11 months, Coleman has proven himself to be a priceless and deeply appreciated ally to the Jewish people. Honestly, in a parallel, insane universe, the Black Jewish Alliance should be the most natural of intersectional confluences, as we have so many shared causes and experiences. So I want to thank you, Coleman, for your allyship, but I also don't want to have to, because common decency and morality should honestly be the default. And it hurts both my head and my heart in this woke age of light and love that the denunciation of anti-Semitism today is anything but a foregone conclusion. Before we get into our discussion, let me just say that the world will be a far better place when we truly wake up to the realization that we all share the intersectionality of humankind, when we can all judge people by the character of themselves and not by the color of their skin or their religion or their nationality. We are the family of man. That being said, allow me to introduce Coleman Hughes. Coleman is an author, podcaster, and opinion columnist who specializes in issues related to race, public policy, and applied ethics. Coleman's writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, National Review, Quillette, City Journal, The Spectator, and The Washington Examiner. He appeared on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2021. In 2019, Hughes testified before the U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee at a hearing on reparations for slavery. And in 2024, Hughes released his first book, The End of Race Politics: Arguments for a Colorblind America. He's appeared on prominent TV shows and podcasts, including The View, Real Time with Bill Maher, The Joe Rogan Experience, and Making Sense with Sam Harris. Hughes is a columnist at the Free Press and a contributor at CNN. Hughes, it's an incredible Hughes. Coleman, I'm a little bit nervous here. This is an incredible CV. I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. And also, I also have to thank Noam for setting this up.
Yeah, no problem. It's great to be here. I saw some of your conversation with Noam, and I'm excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much. So before we get into the topic of intersectionality, I was hoping that maybe we could start with the framework that you lay out in your book, The End to Race Politics, on what is race, and can you make that distinction for the audience of what racism, anti-racism, and neo-racism are? To me, neo-racism is sort of what I would have previously considered reverse racism. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so I have a section in my book called Racism, Anti-Racism, and Neo-Racism. I define racism the same way as it was defined during the Civil Rights Movement by Martin Luther King and by the whole group of activists and writers that were working in those days to bring down the walls of white supremacy and Jim Crow, which is, racism is really any attempt in policy. First of all, it's the doctrine of the congenital inferiority of a people. That's exactly how Martin Luther King defined it in his final book. And it's any policy that inscribes discrimination against whole groups of people simply because they are one race. That's the kind of racism I feel I've always been against. And so real anti-racism is therefore its opposite. It is the spirit of the civil rights movement. It is Martin Luther King's famous dictum to treat people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And in public policy, it's the elimination of any law or policy that discriminates on the basis of race. That's what the civil rights movement, what you could call the long civil rights movement, starting just after slavery with people like Wendell Phillips, going through the creation of the NAACP in the early 20th century, all the way up to the civil rights movement we think of in the 50s and 60s. The consistent goal through those 100 years was the elimination of race-based policy, period, in government. The creation of a, quote, colorblind government, which is what Wendell Phillips called it in 1865. That is a government that cannot see and cannot act on these racial distinctions, right? So ultimately, you can never get rid completely of human prejudice, of the prejudice someone holds in their mind or their heart. And we can never perfect human nature, but we can get rid of, racial discrimination in public policy, and we can raise each new generation of kids on the belief I was raised on, namely that a person's race does not matter, certainly should not matter. And the first person making it matter in an interaction is the one making the mistake.
Okay. So based on that, I hate to sort of double down on the question of racism, but may I just ask, are the Jews considered to be a race? And if so, is anti-Semitism racism? Because while I actually wholeheartedly agree with your premise and the premise of Martin Luther King and the others, at the same time, of course, there are realities of what is going on in the world today. And just to stack on that a little bit, when you say that racism relies on the congenital inferiority of a particular race. And yet, a lot of anti-Semitism is rooted in this trope that Jews control the world, which would be, I guess, the opposite of congenital inferiority. How does this unique nature of anti-Semitism versus general racism actually unfold?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in my book, I kind of, I think I quote Robert Sapolsky, I quote Susan Fiske, who kind of came up with this concept of different kinds of racism. There's racism directed at people because they're considered to be inferior, and there's racism directed at people because they're considered to be essentially, sorry, I apologize, they're doing construction next door, because they're considered to be morally inferior, but in terms of capabilities, superior, right? So the racism against the Jews has, almost everywhere, I think, been a racism directed at a people considered to be morally worse than other humans, but very capable. capable enough to control the world. And you know, it's ridiculous to even entertain it when Jews can't even control the UN, right? And enough to prevent Israel from being denounced more often than all other countries combined, including the worst countries on earth. But the kind of brainworm and mental illness of anti-Semitism has always cast Jews as a kind of secret elite cabal controlling the world. So that's how I would paint that distinction. The racism against the Jews has been different than racism against Black Americans, against Africans, against indigenous people, in that it's cast them as morally inferior, but powerful.
Which I find ironic, because go to any university, go to any museum, go to any public place that has a building that has been dedicated, and look at the name on the building. Doesn't matter if it's in the inner city or if it's in the urban city or if it's anywhere. Oftentimes it is a Jewish name, because Jews, I could tell you, as a people, we are raised with Tikkun Olam, which is healing the world, and Tzedakah, which is charity. And the morally inferior argument lands as ridiculous, bordering on funny for anybody who is either in or deeply familiar with the Jewish community. But that being said, let me go back a minute to what you were talking about, the UN, because you make a very important point about how there are more Security Council resolutions against the Jewish state than all states combined, which is quite surreal. I would like to, for a moment, talk about the concept of Zionism as racism. I'll start by quoting Martin Luther King Jr., who in 1967 said, "When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism." His words, not mine. And as is very famous today, in 1974, in this counter-American effort to delegitimize really Israel as what's now called the little Satan, in America being the big statement, the Satan, the soft underbelly of the Western world. This Arab communist bloc really took over the United Nations and passed this infamous resolution 3379 that Zionism is racism. Now, that was actually, as many people don't seem to know, revoked in 1991 in Resolution 4686, but it's sort of like striking something from the record in court. Once it's been heard, you can't unhear it. In fact, just last week here in Irvine, there were flyers handed out for an anti-Israel rally that literally the slogan was, "Zionism is racism." I mean, it was like straight out of 1974, and as if that concept were never overturned. Just like it's been proven that it was an errant jihadi missile that hit the parking lot of the Al-Ahil Arab hospital, but today there are still millions of people online insisting that it wasn't just the parking lot, but that Israelis bombed the actual hospital. So truth means very little, and bias means a lot. Still, when we go back to the concept of the United Nations and how stacked the deck has been against the state of Israel, it really points to the moral illegitimacy of the body itself as it exists today. So let me just say, I know, and even the United Nations knows, that Zionism is not racism. But is anti-Zionism racism?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I always try to assume the best of people. And so I know lots of people who would probably call themselves anti-Zionists. And the best The most charitable interpretation of them as people is not that they're racist against Jews wholesale, but rather that they genuinely believe that Israel is a settler colonialist project of Europeans oppressing natives. Now, that narrative is wrong for about 10 different reasons, but a lot of them are deeply uneducated about the history of Zionism, about the history of the Jewish refugees who really had no choice but to come to what was British Mandate Palestine when the world closed its doors on the eve of the Holocaust, and have been taken in by propaganda that denies the historical connection of Jews to that land in the first place. So the charitable version is people really don't know that much and are opposing something that they think is an evil, akin to what Christopher Columbus did to the natives in America, whatever, right? So that doesn't require anti-Semitism necessarily to get you to that point of view. However, there are a lot of people who really, who know everything they need to know, and for whom the focus on Israel does stem from anti-Semitism. When it comes to Zionism broadly, what I find interesting is that the word Zionist needs to exist at all, right? Because before 1948, I know exactly what Zionist means as, you know, as a history, as a student of history. A Zionist refers to anyone before, you know, 1948 who sought to establish a homeland for the Jewish people in their historic homeland. When the state's already founded and legitimated by the United Nations, what does it anymore mean to be a Zionist? Does it just mean, I mean, it really just means that you think Israel should continue to exist and have the right to defend itself like any other state. But there's no word for that, right? There's no word for an American that thinks America should keep existing or an Australian that thinks Australians should keep existing, because there doesn't really have to be. There's no one who is continually attacking the continued existence of a UN member state, except for Israel. And that's what I find really bizarre about the Zionism conversation.
There's no doubt that there are extraordinary double standards, or as John Spencer refers to them, triple standards, when it comes to Israel and the Jews. But it's true that the only reason that the concept of Zionism persists to this day, and we were all woken up to this on October 7th, is because, A, there are millions of people, if not billions of people on Earth today, who literally question the legitimacy of the Jewish state. And B, what we're realizing more and more is that as Jews in the diaspora, how much it means to know that, God forbid, should World War II, you know, Kristallnacht, like the whole thing happen again, that we have a place to go to. And so it's sort of a statement now of necessary self-preservation, I think, more than anything. And it is why we need a name. But, you know, Pakistanis who, you know, Pakistan was created basically the same time as Israel, do not need that. You know, Singapore does not need that. You know, all these newer countries, nobody is trying to illegitimize them the way that people constantly are trying to delegitimize the Jewish state.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so when it comes to nationalist movements, of course, one of the big nationalist movements that we all contend with as good and moral people is the white nationalist, right? And ironically, there is no white nationalist out there who would ever consider Jews to be white. And yet, the intersectional anti-Semitic movement has ironically branded us as hyper-white. And as such, we're not even really welcome to the racism conversation, even as it's being forced upon us. I think that what is necessary, but again, also sad, is the way that the Jewish people have been all too eager to point out how colorful we actually are as a nation. But to be honest, being white is not a crime either, right? Like, I should not have to defend my whiteness just because there are Jews who are black. Like, that doesn't resolve anything about who I am or what I represent. So I'm wondering, what are the origins and the dynamics of intersectional identity politics in more specifically, how did the Jewish people fall through this crack?
Yeah, well, so intersectionality has been around since around 1990. And it's an ideology created by Kimberly Crenshaw, who in her defense, she really only meant it to apply to a very... She was really just making an observation about a specific aspect of American discrimination law where, you know, black women, where you couldn't necessarily prove discrimination against black women, but you could prove it against either white women or black men. It was a very kind of, it was kind of paper only scholars in law school ever should have read because it was so niche. But what happened is the word kind of caught on and took a life of its own and came to represent a whole way of thinking about the world where everything in life becomes about how oppressed you are in virtue of your identities, your multiple identities. I, as a man, am thought to have male privilege, but I, as a person of color, am thought to suffer from discrimination. You know, my sister, because she's both black and a woman, is thought to suffer more than I do, to suffer twice as much as I do, because she has essentially two victim identities, and multiply this all the way down the list. Of course, the real world actually doesn't work like this at all. I mean, just in the case of, say, black men and black women, take pretty much any metric, you'll find black women doing quite a bit better right now than black men in America, because the world is complicated and doesn't actually obey simple, childish arithmetic about who is oppressed and who is not. Obviously, the case of Jews, this is another case which defies intersectional logic, because according to intersectionality, Ashkenazi Jews are European and therefore white and therefore the oppressor rather than the oppressed. Now, it's really difficult for any fair historian of the Jewish people to say that Jews are, in general, oppressors in have experienced anything really other than discrimination pretty much throughout most of the history of Europe, throughout the diaspora, in the Middle East, and even in America to a lesser extent, but certainly there's been discrimination here too. So I just think people that have bought into intersectionality have been steeped in it in American colleges. They are slaves to this basic arithmetic that if you're white looking, you're an oppressor. And that's really all there is to it. There's this added fact that American Jews have been very economically successful, despite having come to America, you know, mostly penniless, in many cases, as functionally as refugees from Eastern European pogroms. Throughout the 20th century, and this was much to the admiration of Martin Luther King when he wrote about it, have been able to really live the American dream to a great extent. A lot of that migration was to New York, and were able to succeed. And by the 1940s, American Jews went from arriving penniless at Ellis Island to there's too many Jews now making it into the Ivy Leagues. And so, you know, one of those kind of factoids that people should know is that many Ivy League schools started the whole essay thing, the college essay, kind of as a way of weeding out Jews, because based on test scores alone, Jews were scoring too high for the kind of preferred Protestant balance of those schools. And so in the intersectional logic, if Jews are doing well, therefore they must not have experienced any oppression, because in the mindset of intersectionality, where you are is purely a function of how you've been treated. So if there's a group that is at the top of the income spectrum, it must be that they stole that from somebody, they inherited it, or they just must not have faced any racism. They must have been the ones doing the oppressing to end up with all that wealth.
Sure.
And anyone at the bottom, therefore, must be the opposite. So, I mean, and this is one of the most, again, childish, unsupported views of actually how groups build wealth and build success. If you read Thomas Sowell or Amy Chua or any of the people that have done work on market dominant minorities, often you find minority groups in certain cases have faced the most oppression all over the world. By the way, this is the overseas Chinese in Malaysia, subject to all kinds of riots and pogroms, essentially, but have managed to find a niche in the market and become very successful in certain trades, and therefore have suffered even more resentment as a result. So everything is working in the kind of illogic of the simple intersectional system to tell people that Jews are the oppressors. And so the facts don't matter, essentially. I think that's really what it is. I think many people have kind of predicted that intersectionality would end up at anti-Semitism. There are some people that have been saying that for years. And I think a lot of more progressive American Jews didn't see it that way until October 7th laid it bare. But the logic of it has always pointed in that direction.
It's interesting because the truth is, I think I speak for all Jews when I say that we're really not that interested in the oppression Olympics. Like, as the Jewish people, our, you know, sort of claim to fame is our rise from the ashes, not our fall to the ashes. And there are those who would say, oh, well, maybe, like so many people, if there were no Iron Dome, things would be fairer. If just more Jews would die in Israel, like for five minutes, the Jews of Israel actually did get a little bit of sympathy from the world after 10/7, but then comes the military might, and all of a sudden, you know, Israel defending itself becomes the oppressor once again. And it's this endless cycle of this inverted world where strength is our biggest weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I often think about this because so many American and European commentators that are kind of, let's say, more like center left, even like not far left, they're very sympathetic to Jews when Jews are suffering and powerless. They would be the first ones to speak honestly and reverently about the horrors of the Holocaust. They probably would have been very supportive of the Zionist project in the 1940s, at least in theory. And, you know, the War of Independence, where five Arab armies are arrayed against, you know, the David Goliath story, where a lot of Jews die, where 1% of the population of Israel died in that war. they're sympathetic to that version of the Jewish people and Israel. They're less sympathetic to the version that successfully prevents its people dying. In other words, when, you know, and obviously Israel has invested an enormous amount of capital in defending its own people, probably more than any modern state, in terms of the regulations around building houses that have to have bomb shelters, the Iron Dome, of course, just the practices of how often, you know, if you live, you know, how often you have to run to the bomb shelters and so forth, and how kids are raised to understand exactly how to survive. It's a culture that has been enormously successful at surviving out of necessity. But the result of that is that, well, Israel survives, and that when they have an exchange with someone like Hamas that invests zero in its people surviving, because despite having billions of dollars at its disposal over the years, has not built a single bomb shelter, not even one.
Right. And that they actually not just don't vest themselves in protecting their citizens, they actually vest themselves in getting their own citizens killed by using them as human shields.
Yeah, that's right. So the obvious result of that is that when Hamas starts a war against Israel, lots of Palestinians are going to die, but very few Israelis are going to die. Now, the reason for that is not any particular Israeli brutality. The reason for that is that Hamas invests nothing in the care of its own people, and in fact shoots from behind their shoulders, essentially, whereas Israel places the sanctity of life of its own citizens at the highest priority and is very successful in doing so. And the perverse result of that is those same kind of liberals that would otherwise be very sympathetic to the Jews if they were dying at higher rates suddenly have no sympathy, right?
But the very act of defending yourself with Iron Dome or with bomb shelters is evidence that you are being oppressed rather than oppressing.
Yeah, that's right. It's evidence that you're being oppressed. But it's also evidence that you have very successfully and admirably protected yourself, essentially,
right,
against oppression. And I know that this is one of, I mean, I remember listening to my friend Eli Lake's podcast about Menachem Begin, and the whole kind of attitude of early Zionists was that we're no longer going like lambs to the slaughter. We will be strong. We will defend ourselves. And we're not gonna, you know, the whole slogan of never again is not a slogan. It's a promise, right? What that means is at some level, I think is a lot of Zionists have like steeled themselves, understanding that in becoming more powerful and more able to defend your own people, you naturally lose sympathy, right? And I think they would prefer to be powerful and survive than to be dead and have the world sympathy, and have a second set of beautiful Holocaust museums that we can all visit, you know. And I get that attitude. I mean, that is the attitude I would want my leaders to have if I were similarly placed, right? But I think that warps how people understand the ethics of the situation, because you don't lose the moral high ground just because you get good at protecting your people against threats. That's actually not how morality should work. And you also don't gain the high ground by being weak. In other words, because the Israel and Egypt and America and Europe have successfully starved Hamas of the type of weaponry that Hezbollah has, for example. Because we've done that, that actually does not make Hamas a more moral actor, because the measure of your morality is far more your intentions than your current capabilities, right? Hitler wasn't a better person when he was weak. when he was not allowed to speak in Germany, when he was getting single-digit percent of the vote and he had no real power. He wasn't a better person then. He just didn't have power yet, right? Nor do you become a worse person when you get more power, necessarily. It really matters what your intention is. And the cliche, it's cliche to say at this point, but it actually is the most important thing to know about the Israel-Palestine conflict, if you know nothing else, is that if Israel wanted to commit a genocide, they could do it tomorrow, and they could have done it decades ago. They could have done it decades ago. But they don't, because they actually don't want to. Really, the vast majority of Jews in Israel want to live in peace with their neighbors. They would want nothing more than the relationship that America has with Canada. Whereas, we know exactly what Hamas would do, what the enemies of Israel would do in general, if they only had a chance, because they keep announcing it over and over again. Iran has been saying it for decades. It wants the destruction of Israel. Hamas wants the destruction of Israel. They behave that way the moment they get the opportunity. And so there is no symmetry between the intent on one side and the intent on the other.
100%. And I guess, the intersectionality, again, even beyond oppressed or oppressed, it's so confounding to me. When we think about, gays for Gaza or feminists for Philistine, both groups of whom would literally be thrown off buildings if they were to find themselves under Hamas rule, and ironically, would be fully accepted into the fabric of Israeli society. So as Rabbi David Wolpe put it, if this kind of thinking it's oxymoronic, but it's also just moronic. When did the supposedly smart and intelligent people of this world become such morons and stop thinking critically about the words that come out of their mouth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really know. I graduated from Columbia 4 years ago now, and I knew some of the kinds of kids, many of the kinds of kids, actually, that would have gone to a Gays for Gaza protest. And these kids are not idiots in terms that an IQ test or the SAT would measure. They're perfectly smart by most of those metrics. But they've essentially bought into a kind of cult. At this point, it's big enough to be called a religion in some way. But they've so deeply bought in on faith to this idea that all the evil in the world comes from the Western European inheritance, basically. So what that means is, Arabs can't be homophobic. They couldn't have a homophobia unless they had learned it from the European colonists, right? So how can Gays for Gaza be a problem if the natural state of people of color all around the world is harmony and no bigotry and acceptance and tolerance? It can't be the case that non-European people, it can't be the case that actually the most friendly societies for, LGBTQ people are actually precisely those Western European offshoot societies that you are criticizing. I mean, it's crazy. Go to San Francisco, go to Tel Aviv. You're going to be more accepted in Tel Aviv as a gay person than any other solitary location in the Middle East, 500 miles in any direction. And that's just a fact. It's not a matter of them being dumb. It's a matter of them having bought into what is essentially a new religion founded on hatred of the West and a kind of childish reverence for anything non-Western.
Yeah, and I think that is really what is confounding so many people so much, is how jihadi thinking has come to be construed as somehow progressive? How, I mean, I'm much older than you are. I'm double your age. I'm 53 years old, but growing up, like, I always considered myself progressive. And what that meant was, yes, I did believe in a colorblind society. I did believe in equal rights for all. I did believe and still believe in all of these things. But there's nothing that, like, progressive Shauna of the past would have looked at seeing, you know, angry mobs rioting at Columbia University, you know, destroying Hamilton Hall, threatening Jewish students, and said, oh yeah, no, that's the team that I think conforms to the morals and beliefs that I was brought to believe in my religion of kindness. Like, everything that I'm seeing is the absolute antithesis of everything that I, as a progressive of the 80s and 90s, was taught to honor and respect. How does this jihadi rage find its intersectionality with the peace, love, and happiness hippies or neo-hippies of the new age?
Yeah, that's another good question. I very much identify with the ethos of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King constantly, repeatedly talked and wrote about why it was so important to protest nonviolently, which he had, you know, learned through Gandhi and through Bayard Rustin and others. And part of the reason was that he said, you demonstrate your intent with your methods, right? If your methods are violent, people are going to understand your ultimate intentions to be violent. If your methods are peaceful, people will slowly understand that your intentions are peaceful. So if your intent is to convince Americans, Israeli, and the world that the Palestinian project and desire is for a true peace, why are you busting in the windows of Grand Central Station in New York? Because you're showing me that your main MO is violent just by how you're holding a protest in the middle of Manhattan. The carelessness, the absolute comfort with, you know, these small acts of violence from the people claiming to be for peace. So, I mean, this is, you know, why it's so appealing to students. I mean, I think that there's a certain element of it that is just, like, young people enjoy violence to some degree. Like, I think that's always been true. And especially if you can give people a moral reason to pursue that violence. I mean, this is part of the reason I'm always so resistant to efforts to kind of excuse riots. You know, in 2020, when we had riots all over the country, people, you know, these writers are like searching for the deep reasons why people are rioting. And I just wanted to tell them, don't you remember what it was like to be like a teenage boy full of testosterone, full of energy? Rioting is fun. I know some people are like so out of touch with that side of themselves that they never had it or can't remember, but rioting is fun. And if you give people the green light to do it, a lot of them will do it and couch it in moral terms because it's actually fun.
Sure. And this new intersectionality is really just like the newest manifestation of what we used to call political correctness, right? So we have these generations who have suppressed their angers or their frustrations or their disagreements with the general narrative because it's uncomfortable or downright false, but they suppress that and they let it go. And in this very Orwellian society that we live in, you know, they have to accept that, not to mix metaphors, that black is white. And so I think that there's this hidden rage behind this uber acceptance that it's like, oh, well, we have to accept everything for everyone for everything that they are. And then, yeah, like here, but here's an outlet that you can use. And they're like, oh my goodness, an outlet, right? And in running to it just for the chance to have that moment of retribution against the system, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the irony is like a lot of these students are the same ones that for years have been saying words are violence.
Right.
So it's like, if you ask someone where they're really from, that's basically violence against them. But if you destroy windows in Hamilton Hall, that's not violence, or that's righteous, or something like it. It's a mix of hypersensitivity to the wrong phrase, to the wrong, you know, to anything that's 5 years out of date in terms of terminology, but a kind of lack of sensitivity to just actually violent tactics of creating like a human barrier where Zionists, by which you mean basically Jewish students, like can't come on this lawn right now. So, you know, all of this is to say it's again, kind of a new religion, a new cult with a new set of norms, a new set of taboos that look very strange to a typical American, I would say, of either party, but has outsized influence in all of the meaning-making institutions in the country, from journalism to colleges.
So I guess to me, a lot of this begs the question, is today's intersectionality based on finding a common cause, or is it about finding a common enemy? I found this very interesting or bizarre story. I think it was last week. These days, a week feels like a year, so I'm not sure. I think it was last week, where the Black Student Union at the University of Michigan left the pro-Hamas Tahrir coalition because they felt it was anti-Black. And yet, the BSU, the Black Student Union, continues to be anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, and anti-Semitic. The hypocrisy is quite astounding to say we're leaving your group because you're hateful and we want to be hateful too, but we just don't want to be hateful with you at this time.
Kind of a weird breakup. Like, it's not you, it's me. Well, I think there's one of the least commented upon aspects of this, the whole silliness, is that if we're talking about anti-Black racism, there's quite a bit of it in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. I mean, it wasn't but 5 or 6 years ago, I think, the BBC ran a piece, a few years before that, the New York Times ran a piece about how in the Muslim world, in the Arab Muslim world, Black people are referred to as abed, which means slave. And of course, you know, over 10 million African slaves were taken to the Arab world. It's just populations didn't survive as they did in the West. And so there are very few left as a legacy. I don't see them very much. Which is to say, you will probably find no more open racism, no places that are more openly racist towards people of African descent than in the Middle East. Okay, I lost you, Shauna. You still there? Oh, I lost you for a second, but you're back.
Am I back? Because mine is frozen.
Yeah, you're back. Can hear you. I can hear you fine, but your picture's frozen.
Okay, I don't know what's going on. Sorry, I've been having a lot of troubles with my YouTube Live.
That's okay. I guess people will just have to imagine. Your face is frozen in a good position, though.
Okay, I went black. I'm gone. So, Okay. Well, keep going, please, as long as you can tell me.
So I actually think I think it was a BBC or is actually Associated Press article a few years ago that said in Jerusalem there's a small neighborhood that has a few Africans or people of African descent who have lived there for some time. One of the few kind of probably legacies of slavery that still that are there. And the Palestinians refer to the neighborhood as the slave's corner. So this is not, Palestinian, much less Arab culture, is hardly a bastion of good feeling towards Africans or people of African descent. By contrast, again, you're probably not going to find a place more tolerant of Black people than Israel. Which is not to say there's no racism, right? There's racism everywhere, including in Israel. But I think you will find probably a lot more liberal feeling towards racism against Black people in Israel than you're going to find almost anywhere in the Middle East. I mean, people should look into the fact that, Israelis basically rescued thousands and thousands of Ethiopian Jews and brought them into Israel and made them citizens. Which is not exactly the mark of a fundamentally racist culture against Black people. Though, again, there's going to be discrimination everywhere you go in the world to one extent or another. But yeah, I mean, this is just part of the whole backwards morality of the situation. And the notion that Arabs or Middle Easterners in general must not have a racist or bigoted culture because they're non-Western, essentially. Okay, now I can't hear you, but I can see you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Sorry, I don't know what happened there. Thank you for all that. Sorry, I'm a little flummoxed now because my camera went out. So can I go back though quickly to the question of, and by the way, I believe, and I could be wrong, that the airlift of Israel, of the Ethiopians to Israel to save them from an oppressor country is the only example of a nation bringing Africans in to be something other than slaves, but rather than to save them. But I do want to sort of go back to the question of is today's intersectionality based on finding a common cause or finding a common enemy? Sorry, I know my question sort of went off from that question, so sort of got lost in the shuffle.
Well, I would say it's certainly based on finding a common enemy, which is the avatar of the kind of straight white man, essentially. That's the avatar of the evil figure in intersectionality. And the closer you get to that, the more evil you are. So, a straight white woman is still evil, but not maybe quite as evil. Any country that seems to embody the avatar of straightness and whiteness, a country where, for example, all of our presidents except for one have been at the very least white men, probably most of them straight, but not all. that makes you evil. So, that's pretty much all there is to the intersectional project. In that sense, it's not like, Marxism, communism had this dream of creating a communist utopia that would look a certain way and so forth. And it was a naive and destructive project, but it had a kind of utopia it was searching for. I mean, in theory, you can hear intersectional folks talk about this kind of utopia that's free of racism, free of oppression, an abolitionist culture without prisons, without police. So in that sense, it is it does have that quasi-Marxist, you know, goal, that utopia that recedes every time you grasp for it and never seems to actually exist. And anytime they create, you know, if you like, when they try to create in Seattle the cash chop zone free of cops, it you know, within a week it descends into an absolute nightmare hellscape, which is worse than the thing it was replacing. But in practice, intersectionality is mostly a destructive thing, not a creative thing. It's and it seeks to tear down the legacy of anything that reeks of kind of whiteness or maleness. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that really unites a politically Black student group on campus with a pro-Hamas student group, is that they perceive themselves to have the same enemy, which is, you know, whiteness.
Right. Coleman, because we only have a few minutes until we hit the hour mark, I have to ask you, because I always have 110,000 questions lined up. In respect of your time, do you need to go, or are you okay continuing this conversation?
Oh, yeah, I have to go at the hour.
Okay. Okay, so let me just ask one more question then. So you write for the Free Press, which was famously created by Barry Weiss, who left the New York Times due to the extreme anti-Israel and even anti-Semitic bias there. I contrast that with the decision of Bret Stephens to actually join the editorial board of the New York Times, where he gets to have a voice in an otherwise hostile narrative. You straddle both worlds. You have a strong presence in both the mass and independent media. Which do you think is more effective? Speaking in the echo chamber and just giving people the information and the arguments that they need in a world of difficult conversations, or speaking to the masses and hoping to get through?
I think if you're really good at speaking to the masses on mainstream channels, that might be even the higher value thing to do. I mean, you know, like what Douglas Murray has been doing when Piers Morgan or when he debates Mehdi Hassan, it's a real public service to be able to do that. But look, it's all important. I think it all matters. It's obviously much more difficult to get the truth across in channels that are hostile to it. You're more likely to get cut off. You're more likely to not get invited in the first place. You're likely to get edited unfavorably, and so forth. So I get why it's you know, it's not done as often, but I think it definitely needs to be done. We have a huge problem with echo chambers, and people only consuming the news that their algorithm gives them, and believing they're informed. And so, you know, as much as the kind of free press friendly writing and conversations can be brought to a place like CNN, I think that's all to the good.
Thank you. May I just ask, where do you see as the hope for a colorblind future, or a future that at least doesn't rely on racism as a cornerstone of its being?
The hope I always believe in lies in the fact that each new generation of children is born by default with the right attitude about race. That's one of the great things about children. They're not perfect. They often have inborn flaws that they need to be taught out of. For instance, a lot of children need to be taught to share. They don't necessarily come out the bat sharing, right? But kids really are born with an attitude of not caring about the color of a person's skin or their perceived ethnic background. Kids are obviously, they're curious that human beings come in different shades, but they don't ascribe any deeper meaning to that unless you teach them to. So each new generation of kids is an opportunity to win the fight again against racial essentialism, against racism, against anti-Semitism. And so the fight is never lost in the way that certain other fights can be lost. And I think that's my source for hope.
And I hope that our education system steps up to fill that. Thank you so much for your time, Coleman. This has been the greatest honor. I appreciate it. And I so look forward to hearing your future discussions on all these relevant topics.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Have an amazing day.
All right. Bye-bye.